welcome those of you that are with us for the first time, several faces that weren't with us last week, and we're thrilled you could be with us. We're continuing a series on a topic that we really began Friday, but if you just got here today, I don't think that's any detriment. That's the concept, a series on marriage and the family. And this afternoon, I'd like to deal with the concept of making a home. I think we all rather clearly understand the difference between a house and a home. One is a building and the other is an institution. But in our society, we sometimes cloud the concepts between being a homemaker and a housekeeper. While all of us may not be, in the technical sense of the word, housekeepers, I would like to propose to you that probably all of us that are married, for sure, need to be considered as homemakers. In Titus chapter 2 and verse 5, where Paul is exhorting Titus to exhort the older women to teach the younger, one of the things that he exhorts them to do is to be the keepers at home. There is no more noble task for a woman to be than a maker of a home. But I'm persuaded that there probably is no more noble task for a man to entertain also than to be a maker of a home. Not necessarily the keeper at the home, but the maker of the home. God's given us three institutions in the Bible. He gave us government to protect our lives, He gave us the church to protect our souls, and He gave us the home to protect our families. And of these three, He gave us the home first. Whatever else may be said about the home, it really is the bottom line of life. It's where the attitudes are shaped. It's where reality sets in. And it is truly the right topic for us to be discussing here, because I don't know of anything that concerns me more in terms of the vitality of the church than the effect or the demise, if you will, of the home has on that. It is simply impossible to have a vital society without having vital homes, and it is equally, if not more so, impossible to have a vital church without having vital homes. Words can't express to you, and this hopefully will be about my only personal comment this week, but words can't really express to you what my home means to me. And I think most of you could stand up here and say the exact same thing. If you're in the secular world and you've been away from home for a few days, nothing feels like getting home. If you've been on vacation, even with your family, nothing feels like getting home. And getting home is not returning to the house. It is truly returning to the home. I notice with interest, and I hope I'm not reading too much into this passage, but in Acts chapter 14, verses 27 and 28, we have what I believe is the Apostle Paul returning home after a rather lengthy and after a rather strenuous journey. We sometimes think of the Apostle Paul as being able to lay his pillow at any place and be comfortable any place and have no feelings and affinities for home because he was a spiritual wanderer. And there is some truth to that. But I'm struck by the passage that Luke writes for us in verse 27. And when they were come and had gathered the church together, they rehearsed all that God had done with them and how he had opened the door of faith unto the Gentiles, and they abode long time with the disciples. I think Paul was tickled to death to get home. Didn't mean that he wasn't going to leave again, but there's just nothing like getting home for a Christian. And of all the pressures that you and I sometimes endure, there are none harder to endure than troubles at home. Financial pressure is tough, but usually that passes. Physical pain is hard, but usually there's some hope of relief for that. The loss of a job or failure at school is depressing, but it too shall pass. There is, however, nothing to compare with the lingering, agonizing, torturing heartaches of an unloving mate, a rebellious child, and a broken home. And I would submit to you that for most of us that have endured pain, the most severe of that pain has had something to do with a failure of the home. Sometimes when those in the home are either too big to spank, too immature to reason with, too volatile to threaten, and too stubborn to change, and the home is in dire straits. But it also seems to me like one would have to be a fool to begin making a home without consulting the plan. If any of you have built homes or houses, you don't do that without having a plan. You don't wire the house without a plan. You don't plumb the house without a plan. And you can imagine in your mind what humorous, if they belonged to someone else, things would occur if you tried to wire or plumb your house without a plan. Water coming from the sockets and electricity coming from the faucets. But in something as immaterial as our physical houses, it just absolutely amazes me that the majority of people try to build a home without consulting the plan. And it seems to me to be the essence of foolishness. Maybe I should say the essence of stupidity. Most people, rather than consulting the blueprint that God's given them for a home, rely on rather vague, sketchy things that they've learned from watching their parents, listening to their friends, or studying in school. And then when the home falters, when the home fails, they scratch their heads and say, "I wonder what went wrong." When really they should be saying, "I wonder why it lasted as long as it did." The multitudes choose instead to have their marriage and their homes dissolved and plowed under rather than rebuilt according to the master plan. And don't let anyone fool you, and I know some of you can't be fooled by this because you felt the sting and the heartache of it directly or within your family. Divorce is painful. It's humiliating. It's your worst nightmare. But so is living in a poorly designed home, in my estimation. And I think we all would agree that we need to put away some of our amateur ideas of how you make a home, some of our self-centered ideas about how to pull a family together, and start building on the blueprint that God gave us. When you do that, it may be a little arduous, but the results will be there. It may take longer than you planned. It may cost more than you figured. It may require a lot of sacrifice, and it may take greater determination, but the reward of a godly built home that's blessed by God and designed by God and inhabited by God is an eternal blessing for any man, woman, or child to participate in. I'm going back to where God went and make a few comments on a passage in Genesis, the second chapter. A passage that I think all of us are to a great extent familiar with, but I just couldn't understand how to begin talking about making a home without going back to what God said and then make a few comments that maybe will jog some thinking that you haven't shared. In particular, I'm going to be looking at verse 24. "Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." That is the beginning of the making of a new home. Two individuals that were part of a previous home now leave that home and form a new home. And there are three key principles articulated here that I believe are essential for the successful establishment of a home. And some of these principles the parents don't like. Some of these principles the children don't like. But whether we like them or not, I think we have to examine them. And the first principle that he gives us in the 24th verse is the principle of severance. The principle of these two previously joined to two family units or home units, leaving them and beginning another. And it says, "Leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife." Sounds simple, doesn't it? But I wish I could in some small way convey to you the number of marriages that I see and I suspect you see that are absolutely doomed from the beginning because of the failure of one or both to leave their parents and cleave unto their wife. It says to develop our own ways, to develop new loyalties to our mates, to develop a new unit, not a subunit of an existing home and an existing family. A new unit that's not always quoting, "This is the way Mom did it, and that's the way Dad did it, but now is trying to find a new way to do it." To those of you that are parents, and that includes a lot of us, or grandparents, When your children begin the making of their home, ensure that they leave you. Has nothing to do with geography, has nothing to do with proximity. It has to do with the departing of the emotional attachment. Yes, they'll still be your children. Yes, you'll still be their parent. But you will no longer be, or should no longer be, the central focus of their emotional life. Now that new husband or wife is. I'm slowly beginning to understand how scary and how traumatic that is for parents. When your whole life of 20 years, the last 20 years, has revolved around seeing those children, nurturing them, as we talked a little bit in Rick's class this morning, and then having to knowingly pull back, to bite your lip, to let them fall, to let them scrape their own knees, to build their own home. And I'm going to say this downstairs, and it may apply to some upstairs, but I'll let you know that I'm going to say it. I believe the children need to be extremely sensitive to this and understand how traumatic it is for mom and dad when they do leave. I wish that I had been a little more sensitive to that when I left. And with both the parent and the child understanding this, I believe it can occur. The second principle that he gives us is very similar, but I think it's a little bit different. And he says, cleave unto his wife. The word cleave there means to glue, to cling, to remain intact. It's the word that allowed us to have the writings in Mark chapter 10 and verse 9 where it says, let what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. And it is not a suggestion. It is not an option. It is a commandment. The concept of now cleaving to your new mate is something that is not a multiple choice, take it if you leave it or leave it. It is a fact. And it's the concept of cleaving that's supposed to make our minds think, not how can we get out of this relationship, but how can we make it better? Marriage and the home are not disposable institutions, but they're growing relationships. Margaret Mead, a sociologist in the 1960s, said, and I believe she said it with great wisdom, the number one problem with marriage is that people enter into it with the feeling that it's indispensable and disposable. And as soon as you enter into a relationship with the attitude, if it doesn't work, we'll move on, that relationship's already started not to work. When the thought of possibility of leaving enters a marriage, a crack widens, and if not repaired quickly, the home will crumble. And I believe that the perseverance of our home, the preservation of our families, is even more critical to us as Christians than the preservation of our physical life. The third concept is unity. Here in this verse, he talks about it as being one flesh, but I believe it goes beyond what we would consider physical unity, and it goes into spiritual and emotional unity. It's the concept of love, of loving each other, centering on self-giving rather than self-interest. When two people begin to focus on their responsibilities to one another rather than their rights, as soon as people begin focusing on their rights in a relationship, that relationship begins to crumble. Because your rights are your responsibility to your home and to your family. The power and the authority of the home cannot lie with the children. It has to lie with the parents. Specifically, it has to lie with the father. Not because he's wiser, not because he's smarter, but because the Lord delegated it to him, as we find in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. The power of the home comes from God, and God's delegated it to the parents. We need more home-centered children and fewer centered children, children-centered homes. We need homes in which the children participate in being part of the home rather than homes that are built around satisfying all of the needs of children. And I believe there's a fourth principle that's tied into this concept of unity, and that's the concept of communication. When I ask the younger people, and if time allows, I'll show you an overhead that won't betray any of their confidences, but will give you an idea of what they said downstairs when I asked them, what's the key to making a good marriage and a good home? One of the things they came up with very early was the concept of communication. And I believe it was Jim, it was one of the teachers last week that commented on how women simply are more verbally articulate than men. There's been numerous studies done, and there's no question. It means two things, and we smile at this first one. I think it means they also verbalize more, but I think it also means they may verbalize a little better. One writer described this as that if God gave the woman 50,000 words a day, he gave the man 25,000 words a day. So when the man comes home from work, he's probably used 24,000 of his 25,000 up. And he's perfectly content to grunt through the evening. And she's got 26,000 more words to go. He goes into the front room and turns on the Chicago Cubs or Monday Night Football, and she's chattering away. And they don't understand what's wrong. A law has been proposed by one woman writer that any man who watches more than 100 sports events a year should be claimed legally dead. Then the wife could move on with her life. Maybe that's a little bit drastic, but the concept of communication cannot be overestimated in the concept of the home. And I say this because, men, we have to be sensitive to our wives' need for verbal communication. And I'm looking in the mirror. I have developed, like many of you, good phrases to get me out of sticky situations when I should have been listening and I wasn't. I have found that yes and no are dangerous answers, but the common phrase, "Is that right?" is safe. But now Donna's understood that every time I say, "Is that right?" she says, "You're not listening." So I'm feverishly in pursuit of a new phrase. Men and women are different. That's got to be the understatement. But this emotional need to communicate. Many of us men, if you're like me, you come home or come away from whatever your function is, you're tired, you're exhausted, and you keep much within. The wife wants to hear how the day went, what the problems are. Some of that may not be appropriate to share with her, but I believe a lot of it would be. Usually when you see an introverted, quiet, silent husband, you'll also see a frustrated wife because of the lack of communication. The irony of this whole dilemma is many times very verbose women are attracted to the strong, silent type. And there's really no chance, as that relationship grows, for that man to fully satisfy her need to communicate. We'll touch on that downstairs, and maybe they'll listen a little bit better than we have. The ideal home is a family living in close communion and harmony with God and one another. But we don't all have ideal homes. We know that those that live around us don't have ideal homes, but we also know, if we're honest with ourselves, that many of us don't have ideal homes. I do not have a perfect home. I do not have a perfect marriage. That should be no shock to you, because it's a simple fact. I'm not perfect. And the fact that I'm not perfect makes it impossible for me to have a perfect marriage and me to have a perfect home. I believe I have both of them good, but I don't believe I have both of them perfect. And I don't believe since Adam and Eve sinned in the garden, there has been a perfect marriage. And I don't believe their marriage was perfect once they sinned. Since the sin of Adam and Eve, man has struggled and often failed to build a godly home. I'd like to take you now to Proverbs chapter 24. Because a good question is, okay, we want to make a home. How do we make a godly home? And I believe Solomon gives us a lot of wisdom. We touched on a little bit of it this morning, but I believe in these two verses, Proverbs chapter 24, verses 3 and 4, he gives us some great wisdom in how a godly home is prepared. For many, the solution to a rundown or poorly built home is to simply buy more things or have more kids, hoping that the more things you buy and the more kids you have become the glue that holds the family and the home together. And we've seen that fail and fail and fail and fail. Because things and kids don't hold homes together. They don't hold them together very long. That's why you see a lot of divorces after 20, 25 years. It's that magic mark. You hit your mid-40s, you hit 50, and the divorce rate just soars. The kids are no longer there. What little glue there is has evaporated. But I believe that Solomon tells us that a home cannot be built on any of these things, but it can be built on the bedrock of wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. the third and the fourth verse of that chapter, through wisdom is a house builded, and by understanding it is established, and by knowledge shall the chambers be filled with all precious and pleasant riches. Wouldn't you love for your home to have every corner of it filled with precious and pleasant riches? I believe Solomon tells you that you can. But he gives us three verbs in these two verses that I want us just to take a little bit. He first of all says it has to be builded, established, and filled. The Hebrew word there for builded is the same word that we find in Genesis where it said, and God took a rib out of Adam and he made Eve. One's translated made and the other's translated builded, but it's the same Hebrew word. It means to restore so that it will flourish. He took the rib of Adam and restored it, rebuilt it, so that it would flourish. And he says, wisdom will do the same thing for a home. The hope of this verse regarding the home is that even if we have a home that's in disrepair, it can be restored to a flourishing state with wisdom. And then the second verb, to establish, that we find in the latter part, to set in order, to place in an upright position. By understanding, the home is set in order, it's made right, it's stabilized, it's put on a firm foundation. And it's the husband and the wife that have to bring this understanding to the unit. Wisdom, understanding. And then be filled with overflowing by knowledge. Knowledge bringing the fulfillment and the satisfaction of each part in the home. A wise, an understanding, and a knowledgeable base. Put all three together, and Solomon says that a home and a marriage and a family can be built and made to flourish, to be set right in order, and to overflow with pleasant and precious riches. But Solomon goes further, and he says, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge are the keys. Wisdom, stressing discernment, being able to see below the surface of things. Oh, if we could see below the surface chatter of the home and see what's really in the hearts of our wives, of our husbands, and of our children. It's been said, and I believe there's partial truth to this at least, that the key to a good marriage is to have your eyes wide open before you get married and half closed after you get married. To look intensely for those characteristics in a mate before you choose them and then be willing to overlook some of their faults after you choose them. But we often get that reversed. We overlook their faults while we're selecting and scrutinize their faults with a microscope once we've said, I do. I do does not mean scrutinize. I do means love. Understanding to reason, skillfulness and intelligence, knowledge, the awareness and the perception. Where are these things going to come from? Where does wisdom come from? Where does understanding come from? Where does knowledge come from? Hebrews. Proverbs 2 and 6 says, for the Lord gives wisdom, and out of his mouth come knowledge and understanding. Only God can provide the tools needed to build a home, and we've got to learn to skillfully use them. This means the Lord must be the cornerstone of our home. Psalms 127, unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. As a side point here, I'd just like to make a comment. It often comes up, must we marry in the Lord? Seems to me like when we choose not to marry in the Lord, we're trying to build our home with one hot hand tied behind our back. It will be strenuous, it will be difficult, and for most times, to truly build a home, it will become impossible. It seems like a very foolish position for us to put ourselves in. I'd like to take about 5 minutes now and just give you a list of what I think are some of the most treacherous destroyers of the home. It's not going to be a complete list, but I want to give you that list and then leave you a little bit of time to articulate your thoughts on this. But I believe one of the great destroyers of the home is favoritism. There's a passage back in Genesis chapter 25, and it goes on over into chapter 27. But it's the story of Esau and Jacob. And you know that Isaac, it says in verse 28, loved Esau, and Rebekah loved Jacob. Favoritism with our children, favoritism with our parents. Some of us that aren't living in the home and have living parents could be guilty of showing favoritism to one parent over the other. It's an instant recipe for disaster, and I just ask you to listen as I read, if you're not back there, turning over to chapter 26 of Genesis and verses 34 and 5. And Esau was 40 years old when he took a wife, Judith, the daughter of Bri, the Hittite, and dropping down to verse 35, which were a grief of the mind of Isaac and Rebekah. And I go on over to chapter 27 in the last verse there, verse 46. And Rebekah said to Isaac, I am weary of my life because of the daughters of Heth. Favoritism in the home has absolutely no place, and it's hard to do, because one of them's going to look a little bit more like you or act a little bit more like you. One's going to respond to your every whim, and one's going to rebel to your every whim. Your mom or your dad's going to have a special ability to communicate with you, and you have a soft spot in their heart. But favoritism has no place in the home. Number two, a lack of leadership and a lack of discipline. In the interest of time, I'll just give you this one. But you remember in 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verses 27 to the end of that chapter, we know that Eli had a very difficult time raising his family, and his family, in essence, was cut off from their service to God due to an undisciplined behavior. But in 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 29, I believe that verse tells us that Eli, in essence, did not discipline his sons, and he was held accountable for it. You simply cannot have an undisciplined home, and that discipline has to come from the parents. Primarily, specifically, it's a responsibility of the man. Bad examples, number three. Do what we say, not what we do. Oh, if I could just say to parents sometimes what I would like to say in my heart, but I know it might hurt them. When they ask, what's wrong with this person and what's wrong with that child, and you look at them and you want to say, well, they're just growing up to act like you. And that's time, true, time after time after time. Without trying, we model and show our values, demonstrating what we really, truly find to be important. Don't tell me you think going to church is important. Show me that you think going to church is important. Like father, like son's probably not a cliche. It's many times a truth. It's not an absolute truth. It's not true all the time. But it's true more times than we like to admit. Bad examples are particularly injuries. Sometimes good examples aren't enough. If a good example was enough, if being a perfect parent meant you have perfect children, then the children of Israel would have been perfect because they had a perfect parent, God. But bad examples can be terrible. Number four, anger. And I'll simply reference Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4, where it tells us not to provoke our children to wrath. But children see anger amongst the parents, and it causes great strife. Down at Eminence, I had the chance of spending about 45 minutes with the junior high class, and I asked them in privacy on a piece of paper to tell me what their parents did that they wished they didn't do. Number one was they didn't communicate, and number two is they fought. But these aren't children of the world. These are children of the children of God. Number five, lack of respect. Give your family somebody to respect. Your kids and your wife or your husband may love you because of who they are, but they'll respect you only because of what you are. And love and respect don't automatically go side by side. I believe Jonathan loved Saul. I don't believe Jonathan respected Saul. I believe many children grow up loving their parents but being unable to respect their parents. Give your children something worthy of their respect. Love is not enough. I don't care what the radio says. Love does not conquer all. The divorce courts are full of people in love. There must be more. Number six maybe is a pet peeve of mine. It's called this concept of lack of time. We often hear the phrase, I don't have much time with my kids, but I give them quality time. Well, I believe there's a Greek word that explains quality time. It's spelled H-O-G-W-A-S-H, hogwash. Because quality time is oftentimes simply a rationalization and a justification for a lack of time. I'm all for quality time, but your children know what's important to you by what you fill your time with. And if it's work, if it's golf, if it's the garden club, if it's keeping the house even, their antennae are out and their perception is great. And number seven, I'll simply call it role confusion. Never has a society suffered from any greater role confusion than I believe our society suffers from. And our society is doing all that it can to blur the roles of the family, often trying to make the mom the dad and the dad the mom, the children the parents and the parents the children. The roles of men and women are a major target of those who want to change and destroy the home. The women's movement has been extremely successful in altering the way women see themselves at the home and in society. And in the process, every traditional concept of family value has been discredited and scorned. Women are seen as oppressed and men as bungling fools. The term housewife has become a pathetic symbol of exploitation, oppression, and in many people's minds, stupidity by the feminist movement. We can make few mistakes greater as a nation than to continue this pervasive and disrespectful show to women who devote their lives to the making of the home. If you don't make the home, nothing else matters because nothing else survives. The church, the government, the nations, all centered around the home. I'm going to pause here because I get myself into time trouble, and I'll give you a chance to make comments or ask questions before I continue, if there are any. Mike?
Do you think there's any significance in Genesis, the second chapter, where it mentions of only the man, so shall a man leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh? It doesn't say that of the woman.
I don't take any significance really from that, Mike, because of the passages in, say, Ephesians chapter 5, where the wife is now submitting to her husband, and I think that implies him being her primary focus of devotion. Okay. Anybody else have a comment on that? I'd entertain it, but I don't take great significance from that. Any more than I take significance from the fact that Adam and Eve didn't have a father and mother. You know, I think this was setting up a principle. There was no... Eve couldn't have cleaved to her father and mother if she'd have wanted to. Maybe she had too much time on her hands and she went to the vegetable bin.
One thing that concerns me in the home and is a danger, a divisive element, is the stereotype. The man says a man isn't supposed to do that. A woman says, well, a woman's not supposed to do this. In other words, what I conceive as my job in the home and what she conceives as my job are altogether different. What I see as her work and what she sees as her work are altogether different. And sometimes the twain never desire to meet.
Sure.
When this happens, she is constantly berating him because he isn't doing what she thinks he should, and he very frequently replies in kind because she's not doing what he thinks she should. Mm-hmm. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, I think it can happen. I think it can happen even in Christian homes, but I think it's even more apt to happen in a non-Christian marriage where neither one has, hopefully, a similar set of values. I think that's why, for me, the blueprint is key, and I think it's good for a couple that's perceiving marriage and certainly a couple that's just married to sit down with the Bible and try to understand what God wants them to do and then what works for them. I think it also touches on the area of communication. And I don't mean to preach to you. You know, I've said this before. This is a great class to preach, to teach when your wife's not here. But it's extremely important for you to communicate and understand what each of your expectations are. Let's go over here, and then we'll get Marvin.
Yeah, I just wanted to agree with you on the role confusion one, because I've wrestled with that myself, because my parents divorced when I was 13. I didn't have the role model. And also when I was in school, being pushed to excel, like they said, the influence is there to take away the feminine characteristics in the home.
Absolutely. I haven't done a survey downstairs, but it's a high percentage of those kids downstairs that have some kind of family dysfunction in their past. I don't mind alienating you to at least express myself. It's not my intent. But I get very nervous in home situations where the wife may well have a greater ability to earn money than the man, and they go into this role reversal of mom and pop. Because I get real nervous about that because of the long-term effect I can think it can have on their relationship and because of the role model that sets for their children. I'm not personally against a woman working outside the home, and I believe the Bible will support that, but I believe the woman's primary role must remain her family and the providing of the nurturing of the children. Now, that's also the father's primary role, but he's also been given commandments in the Bible to provide for them in some areas that maybe she's not commanded to, and vice versa. Marvin?
We have an old saying that if you want to know what the calf is going to grow up to be like, just look at the cow. And I think young people, in choosing a mate, pretty good rule of thumb, if you want to know what your wife's going to be like when she gets to be a mother, just look at her mother.
Yeah, that'd slow some marriages down, wouldn't it? Where are we at over here? It wouldn't have affected mine.
Jerry. Now, you have your Bible open up there.
Yeah, it's on page 3. Go ahead.
Oh, boy. Let's see. Well, in the book of Proverbs,
yes.
Chapter 21, verse 9.
Okay.
Would you care to read that for our hearing?
I'll sure.
That's all I'm going to say.
Okay, that's probably be all I'll do then. Okay. I'm sorry, that's 21:9?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, that's a good one. It is better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than with a brawling woman in a wide house. But I don't think that's a gender thing. I think you could say that it's better for her to be on a housetop than to be with a brawling man. On a serious note, there is a lot of things worse than being single. And I believe Paul articulates to that. And as parents, please do not pressure your kids toward marriage. It'll happen if it's supposed to happen, but I'd much rather have two bachelors as my sons than two unhappy homes. And inadvertently, I think we're getting a little bit better about this, but just little innuendos. Found anyone yet? The pressure we put on, especially I think we put it on the girls. A girl gets to be 25 and she's not married, we wonder what's wrong. A boy that's 25 and he's not married, that's neat. He's just a crazy bachelor. Rob?
I was going to say, I think we need to teach people that they need to be happy with themselves so they won't get into marriage thinking the marriage is what's going to make them happy.
That's right.
When they're happy with themselves, then they're ready to think about trying to make somebody else happy.
Marriage doesn't solve a lot of problems any more than switching mates solves problems, because we tend to take those problems with us. Marriage can solve loneliness. It can be a spiritually, and should be, and for most of us is, a spiritually fulfilling experience. But it has to be carefully considered. This is a hard topic for us. It's a hard topic for the kids. I mean, they all intellectually agree with everything we're saying, but when those hormones get pumping, the mind sometimes shuts down. And that doesn't stop once you're a teenager. There's no fool like an old fool. Do we have another one somewhere? All right, Lowell.
On letting go, I think that's probably directly related to how effective you felt you were as a parent.
Would you say that again, please?
On letting go when your children marry, mm-hmm. as losing both hours within 3 weeks, to me, that has really been something we've faced, and to me, it's directly related to how effective you felt you were as a parent. If you felt you were effective with that child, it seemed like easy to let them go.
That's
if
right.
you feel like there's some, you have some misgivings or some doubts, then I think that's when it's you think, well, you wish you had them a little longer, possibly.
Sure. And I also believe, in addition to that, which I agree with, it's also a function of the relationship you and your wife have. If you and your wife have a good relationship, then when those children are gone, then you can take that relationship into deeper and more fulfilling areas. If you and your wife really have a poor relationship and all that's you have in common are your children, it can be extremely stressful. And I'm not saying that when your children get married, it's not there's not a tear in your eye, it's not a moment of sadness. I know that it is, and that's natural. But your job is to work yourself out of a job, not to perpetually keep them dependent on you. It'll be interesting to see what I say in a few years, because I'll have to go through that. I know. But I believe what's intellectually correct will still be intellectually correct, irregardless of how I reacted. We've got a few minutes. Anybody else have anything they wanted to share? Well, we've got Lee up here. Had a four-year-old girl in the back. That'd be interesting. Lee?
I wondered if you wanted to say anything about pressures from in-laws creating problems in a home.
No, I can't leave that way because I have not had that problem really, severely. I think in-laws can exert pressures, but I think your parents can also exert pressures. The tendency to vicariously continue to live their lives through their children can be very detrimental to that family unit. There was a time in my life where I thought everyone that got married should move some geographical distance away from both sets of parents. I don't think that's absolutely necessary, but there has to be a breaking of that tie. Sometimes in-laws can exert pressure when they just can't accept that there's anyone good enough for their child. Did you have a different angle on that that I'm missing? Okay, no personal comments. Okay. It's interesting, though. That in-law relationship can be absolutely great. Absolutely great. My mom enjoys being with my wife every bit as much and sometimes more than she enjoys being with me because they've got a common bond that they have. And that makes me no jealousy. I'm just pleased that it's that way. I'm just thrilled that it's that way. Anybody else? Okay. There is and we're going to deal some on Friday with this concept of as the family changes, because it does change. You change, your husband changes, the children change, they grow up. And probably all of us here have been guilty of looking at our children and uttering the famous phrase, "When will you grow up?" And parenting can sometimes be frustrating. Even with the help of a good mate, it's a challenge, it's difficult. Anyone that through circumstances beyond their control is attempting or having to attempt to do this as a single parent has my undying support and my undying admiration and my undying prayers. And most children are today from homes that do not have the original set of parents in that home. The concept of having a mother and a father that have been together since marriage is a rarity in the United States. There are times when our hearts cry, when the date doesn't show to pick them up, when they're double-crossed by their best friend, when they get that rejection slip from college or they lose that first job. They turn to us for answers, and all we can say is it's part of growing up. But then there are moments of joy, moments of closeness.
an awkward hug when he becomes a teenager and you thought he was out of hugs. A glance in the semi-darkness when you go in and turn off the test pattern and they're asleep. A pride rings through your heart when they walk into the room and unexpectedly say, "Yes, sir," and "Thank you, ma'am." And you catch a wistfulness on their face as they pick up a little baby and you somehow for the first time see that maybe they will be parents themselves. But you're still asking, when will they grow up? You find yourself walking through the house and automatically shutting the refrigerator door that's already shut, picking up a towel that's already picked up, looking for a